Please be seated.
Before we come to your next witness, Ms. Riley, just a question, I guess everybody in the room. We've had an application filed today seeking leave for supplementary evidence to be filed by Dr. Tony Davron, and that was filed without leave being sought on Friday, and I understand from Madam Registrar that the evidence hasn't been circulated, and I haven't read it. Although my colleagues have read it, it could be, it certainly is evidence to do with the Schedule 10A4 methodology. It may or may not acknowledge also the JWS, and if it doesn't, that's potentially problematic. How do you want me to deal with this? It's a bit odd that they haven't circulated the evidence. Oh, sorry, I had at least assumed that much, but I'm told by Ms. Chow that that's not correct.
I do have a copy of it. I received it through one of the council's witnesses who had provided some comments on it, so I'm pretty sure it's the same document that I read last night, a supplementary brief of evidence about the schedule.
Yeah, 16th, dated 16th of April.
Yes.
I mean, people should not be filing evidence without first seeking the legal court, so that's why I haven't looked at it, because it came in late Friday.
Yes, yep. And I couldn't find it. We were in the usual places, but it was in my inbox for different reasons.
So it hasn't been served on you?
Ms. Mallett might be able to explain just how we have a version of it.
Yep.
Your Honour, I understand that when the experts have been discussing amendments to the schedule over the last week, in response to provisions that were circulated by Mr. Wilson, Dr. Davron responded saying he had dealt with it in a supplementary brief of evidence, and then I understand that Council did provide us with a copy of that.
Do you think everybody else has it who might be interested in the schedule, or you don't know?
I don't know who was on that circulation list, but I can check and confirm that if that would be of assistance.
If you could ask Mr. Reid whether he has served on all other parties together with his application for leave and ascertain what folks' position is on the same thing. But I didn't think that we'd get this via an updated updated brief, supplementary brief of evidence. I thought if there was agreement or disagreement, the matter would just simply sheet home to go off and to further expert conferencing. Was my understanding?
Yes, and I don't know that it was necessarily, I'm not sure about the basis for filing that evidence for that party, just that is how we
got it.
Received a copy of it.
Okay.
It was in that context.
All right, with that in mind, Mr. Moore, what's your thinking around this? I mean, there has been some testing of those provisions by the court. When I say provisions, not Schedule 4, the schedule, but the controlled activity RDA rules, because of some amendments made there, highlighting where further evidence is required. And as I said, I'll release a minute about that. Still on track to doing that today, particularly if we finish early. Beyond that, we've stayed out of the schedule.
Two thoughts occur. The first, and perhaps a reflection of having read the document, I was left a little unclear about what it was, and the version of the schedule being attached, it simply looked like an entirely new thing. It wasn't a track change version to the schedule, and I haven't yet done the comparative analysis between what's been put forward and what it is where it differs. I mean, I had understood that insofar as there were still live issues associated with the methodology, there might be some further conferencing in relation to points that hadn't been finalised.
That's right, and I say that was the case on Friday because I released a minute about that.
So it seems a little premature to then see that which has been filed.
How do you want to proceed? Do you want to, did you have questions for Dr. Davron anyway tomorrow?
There's nothing written on my piece of paper. I had highlighted in the version. I quickly skimmed through it just in case we were to make it to Mr. Davern today.
Mm.
And I would have had some questions about the content of the schedule if he was giving fresh evidence on a schedule that's substantially different from the version that is included in the joint witness statement.
Mm.
So, yes, I would have had questions in short.
Mm. And fishing for Forest and Bird are not asking questions, though they're down for questions, is that right?
Are you sure they are not here this week either?
All right, so just you. Down for questions. And so you're saying that if he wants to pursue a different version, you'd have questions?
Yes, and I must say, I looked at it, because it wasn't a tracked version, I couldn't easily tell just how different it was to the 8 April version.
Yeah, okay.
Was tonight's homework. It's a page and a half long versus... I'm not sure what the... Yeah, I suspect it's quite different. I'm just looking at the length of it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wow, it does look different. Okay, so that does actually look quite different, and the significance of the differences, I don't know. But why you'd have why the witness would want to depart from the joint witness statement at this stage, I don't know either. How do you want to handle it?
Well, an application for leave hasn't been filed.
Well, it has now because it wasn't on Friday, and so we've got that. It's four paragraphs, and I'm assuming you've got that too? No? Yep, you've got that. I'm just told Dr. Davern's a witness, so his evidence is as up-to-date as possible and helpful to the court. He has filed a supplementary statement, which he discusses the outcome of conferencing as it pertains to parties. Therefore, parties, I guess, which is... parties Mr. Reed represents seek leave to file the supplementary evidence. That is outcome of conferencing. It kind of suggests that your people are in behind on this, whereas we don't know that that's the case.
Based on comments that I've seen expressing concerns about that which is put forward, I would respectfully suggest that's not the case.
Okay, so is the way to handle that to say we'll hear from Mr. Reed tomorrow, but that leave, given that the subject matter of the schedule are live matters informally being conferenced as between experts, with the direction that it go into formal expert conferencing if not completed on Wednesday, the preliminary thinking is that the supplementary evidence not be filed. Leave declined.
Yes. Yes, I think that's where we reach.
Did you get that? Yeah. Do you want to just note that up in a draft direction and I'll confirm it and send it out? Dr. Davern will be here anyway tomorrow. You'd still have questions for him if he was in terms of the JWS today?
I would have pursued with him the... a line of questions that I've been putting in terms of where there is a difference in terms of the date range, etc.
So I would have
been pursuing those topics. And insofar as there were other major departures, if leave was granted, I would explore those. But I wonder whether that's just premature at this stage, pending some further conferencing.
So we need to hear from Mr. Reed. But what I'll do is I'll give a preliminary indication back via... an email to be released by the registry indicating what I've just indicated, and Ms. Cho is drafting that, and I'll have a look at it in the afternoon break and confirm that, and then we'll send that out, and then Mr. Reed will know where we all stand on that. Yep. Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Dr. Hume.
Mm-hmm.
It's a summary.
I do.
And I'll actually draft you the direction and just hand it up to you in a moment, okay?
You confirm that your full name is Lionel John Hume?
Yes.
And you are employed as a senior policy advisor by Federated Farmers based in Canterbury?
Yes.
You prepared a statement of evidence in chief dated 5 February 2021?
Yes, I did.
Are there any corrections you wish to make to that statement of evidence?
No.
Your qualifications and experience are set out in that statement of evidence?
Yes.
You have participated in joint witness conferencing?
Yes.
And in particular, you participated in the conferencing in relation to the primary sector on Schedule 10A4?
Yeah, I participated in 10A4 and then I was involved in the briefing of the following caucus groups.
So you're a signatory to the primary sector joint witness statement?
Yes.
But you're not a signatory to any of the other statements?
No.
You confirm that the evidence that you've given is true and correct to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes, I do.
Now, I understand that you've prepared a summary statement of evidence, and I'd invite you now to read your summary for the court.
Okay, thank you. Rule 10.A.3.1, which is controlled activity status, sets rates and volumes of take for resource consents to replace deemed permits or existing water permits which expire prior to 31st December 2025. Rates and volumes of take are to be calculated in accordance with the methods in Schedule 10A4. Rates or volumes of take that do not comply with the conditions of Rule 10A.3.1, including the methods in Schedule 10A4, have non-complying activity status. That's in the notified version of Plan Change 7. My evidence statement is about the effect, is essentially about the effective, efficient and sustainable allocation of water, consistent with the Plan Change 7 objective to transition towards the long-term sustainable management of surface water resources in the Otago region. In my view, the best way to achieve sustainable management of surface water in the Otago region, or anywhere else for that matter, for the purpose of irrigation, is to allocate sufficient water to effectively grow the crop that the irrigator wishes to grow and to ensure that the crop can be grown reliably over time. Reliability needs to be at least 90%, i.e. the water supply needs to be sufficiently reliable to provide the full allocation in 9 years out of 10. This is particularly crucial for high-value crops. Allocation needs to be based on crop need, and that need must be reliably met. The methodology proposed in Schedule 10A4 is problematic because it is based on the previous use of water over a relatively short, unrepresentative time frame. Further, it has been clearly demonstrated that the use of this methodology will probably leave irrigators water short in a significant proportion of years. And in this regard, I refer to the evidence statement of Mr. Ian McIndoe, and will hamper the efficient and effective use of water for irrigation. There is well-established and reliable methodology for estimating crop water needs for specific crops under specific climatic conditions and with particular soil water-holding properties. And this is contained in the FAO Irrigation and Drainage Paper number 56. Similar modelling methodology has been used in New Zealand to estimate crop water needs for specific climatic conditions and soil water holding properties, while also building in reliability and efficiency criteria. One example, which I also referred to in my initial evidence statement, is Method 2 of Schedule 10 in Canterbury's Land and Water Regional Plan. This methodology appears to be working well and gaining widespread acceptance among irrigators. Similar methodology has been used by Aqualink Research Limited to prepare a set of guidelines for irrigation water requirements for the Otago region. And this is entitled Guidelines for Reasonable Irrigation Water Requirements in the Otago Region. It was prepared by Aqualink Research for Otago Regional Council and dated 24th of the 7th, 2017. As it stands, the methodology in Schedule 10A4 of Plan Change 7 is likely to leave irrigators short of water in a significant number of years. It is my view that amendments need to be made to Plan Change 7 that I believe are already in process, including as a result of matters agreed in the Primary Sector Joint Witness Statement. Firstly, the methodology in Schedule 10A4 should be regarded as a strictly interim measure, whereby water users may obtain permits using a relatively cost-effective consenting path. Secondly, Schedule 10A4 needs to be made more workable, including by the use of daily, monthly, and annual maxima instead of averages. There is also a strong argument for using only annual data and that daily and monthly allocations are not necessary. Given the potential for unintended adverse consequences resulting from the use of the Schedule 10A4 methodology, I believe there needs to be an alternative consenting path to enable access to alternative allocation methodology such as that in the Aqualink guidelines referred to previously. The newly restricted discretionary pathway would provide this. Even though Plan Change 7 is an interim planning framework, I believe the opportunity should be taken to most effectively work towards the Plan Change 7 objective, namely to transition towards the long-term sustainable management of surface water resources in the Otago region.
Thank you for your summary. Does the court have any questions in relation to the summary? Were you happy for me to proceed with my questions?
Happy to proceed. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right, now I do have some questions. The first of which, I'd be assisted if you could help me understand the scope of your expertise in relation to the preparation of the schedule and sort of where the bounds of your expertise lie, given that you've referred to the expert, for example, of expertise of Mr. McIndoe in relation to Aqualink, etc. Do you have a working knowledge of the likes of the Aqualink model?
I know what it does. I don't understand the intimate inner workings of it. I primarily approach these issues from a plant and soil science perspective. So, yeah, I've got an understanding of plants' water needs and how they arise. And I'm aware of some of the work that's been done around modelling plant water requirements.
When you think about Schedule 10A4, what do you understand its purpose to be?
Yeah, my understanding is that it's an interim methodology to try and hold the line while Otago Regional Council develops a more comprehensive plan, including presumably limit-setting processes and that sort of thing. In a way, to my mind, it seems to be a little bit back to front. I would have thought the limit setting side of things should be done first, really.
In a perfect world, that is probably the case, but we live in an imperfect world without those limits in place, at least insofar as the Otago region is concerned. When you think about Schedule 10A4 and you think about the key outcomes that it's seeking to achieve, do you share the view expressed by Mr. Wilson and Mr. Leslie in relation to those three outcomes? And those outcomes are recorded in the joint witness statement, paragraph 1.
Well, they really are what they are. They relate to Plan Change 7, and you know, very people might have opinions on whether those key outcomes are a good idea or not, but they are what they are.
So when we think about what Schedule 10A4 is seeking to achieve, it's seeking to achieve these three outcomes?
I'm not sure that it effectively does achieve those three outcomes.
Well, let's work through them then. So the first one, to ensure that applicants are not allocated a higher instantaneous rate of take or volume of water than their existing water permit. So what's the, is that
yeah,
one you have an issue with?
Yeah, I don't have an issue with that one.
Okay, which of the three is it that you do have an issue with?
I think B, to ensure that applicants are allocated water at a rate and at a volume that reflects their past actual water use, on the basis that my understanding is that the range of years selected over which water records will be included isn't particularly representative of potential water demand. For example, I don't think those years contain a 1 in 10 dry year, for example.
So you have in your mind that date restriction, I think it was a 5-year date restriction in mind when you're passing, when you're giving that opinion?
Yes.
And are you familiar with the changes that have been made or recommended by the planners in response to the content of the joint witness statements?
Yes, and to the effect that any water data can be, any metering data can be used.
Now, I do have some questions with you about whether that should be a future-looking set of data, but assuming that the earlier date restriction, the 2015 date, was to fall away, would that address your concerns as to whether or not the schedule is reflecting actual historic water use?
Not entirely, because as you're aware, the water metering regulations really only started to take effect in 2012 and then only for takes over 20 litres per second, and then the lower, smaller takes came in 2014 and 2016. So if people were, unless people had installed water meters for some reason other than complying with the regulation, then there could very well be incomplete, very incomplete data prior to those dates.
Do you accept the proposition that one of the outcomes that Schedule 10A4 and indeed Plan Change 7 is seeking to achieve is that applicants be reallocated their historical rate of take and volume of water?
Could you repeat that question, please?
Do you accept as a general proposition that Schedule 10A4 and Plan Change 7 seek to reallocate to water permit holders water rate and water at a rate and volume reflective of their historical use?
Yes.
What Plan Change 7 and Schedule 10A4 is not seeking to do is to allocate water based on the reasonable need for water. That's a different concept, isn't it?
It is.
And insofar as the calculation of reasonable use or reasonable need, that may result in an allocation that is different or not reflective of historical use.
It wouldn't necessarily reflect historical use. But that's if, for example, we went down the route of using the Aqualink methodology, that could be either greater than or less than historical use, because the Aqualink methodology builds in 80% application efficiency, which some methods of application would struggle to achieve.
And so if one of the outcomes of Plan Change 7 is to reflect historical use, then great care would need to be taken in referring to models that are framed up based on reasonable use.
Yes, that's true. I guess probably the concern we've got is that things could go the other way, given that it's very likely that people could end up being water short using the historical use method rather than getting actually what they need.
Now, when you say that users might end up water short, is that because there's simply insufficient resource available, or because the allocation under the schedule reflecting historical maxima doesn't reflect their needs?
I would say the latter. Their needs are not reflected potentially by the methodology.
Now, you've participated in joint witness conferencing?
Yes.
Well, I'll flip that around. Where have you expressed your concerns with the shift towards the use of maxima in the schedule? Do you maintain a view that the use of maxima for both rate of take, daily, monthly and annual volume is not appropriate in the context of the schedule?
The use of maxima?
Yes, so the notified version had some averaging of maxima, and the joint witnesses, I understood, had recognised that that created some difficulties and may not be reflective of historical use, and thus a shift to maxima was recommended and picked up by the planners.
Yes, I supported that.
Now, does that address your concern in relation to whether Schedule 10A4 is accurately able then to reflect historical use?
To some extent, it gets around that issue to some extent. It also gets around the issue of another issue, which is the issue of missing data, which is an issue, obviously, if one is taking averages.
When I read your evidence in chief and as I listen to your summary given this afternoon, I'm left a little unclear as to whether or not you are supporting the use of Schedule 10A4 or whether you are recommending that the court move away from the use of Schedule 10A4 and shift towards a reasonable use type calculation. What is your opinion in relation to the use of Schedule 10A4 as recommended by the planners picking up on the technical conferencing?
I think in an ideal world, reasonable use allocation is the most logical and useful way to go. Given the aims of Schedule 10A4, I think if we use maxima and do the other things that the joint witness statement agreed upon, I think Schedule 10A4 becomes much more usable, and certainly I would be happy for it to be used as the in the activity status that it is, as long as there was a reasonably accessible alternative path for those for whom the schedule didn't work.
Now, when you think about that, and your words for those for whom the schedule doesn't work out, what do you have in mind? What's the gap that is potentially left?
I guess the obvious answer to that is where the period of water meter data the consent holder has access to doesn't include a sufficient number of years to include a, say, a 1 in 10 dry year. So they don't truly have a measure of water use in a year when they really needed to use water the most.
And so in relation to that gap, how do you recommend it that it is filled?
Well, if such a gap can be demonstrated, then people have access to a restricted discretionary activity pathway.
In your mind, is it important that that restricted discretionary activity pathway continues to achieve an outcome of reflecting historical use?
If the applicant was concerned that the alternative, the restricted discretionary pathway wasn't going to reflect their historical use, in other words, if they had an irrigation system that they knew wasn't going to be able to deliver on the volume that they would be allocated via a reasonable use methodology, then they would probably stick to the Schedule 10A4 pathway, I would suggest.
Carl, sorry, can you say that again?
Say that again. Okay, so the question was, maybe you should repeat the question, sir.
We can't remember.
No, we can't. Absolutely.
I was concentrating on the last year. Can you, anyway, what were you trying to say?
Sorry, Your Honour.
No, what were you trying to say? Go ahead.
I think we were talking about what happens in the scenario if someone enters the restricted discretionary pathway and ends up with a number that's smaller than their historical use.
So there's two scenarios which have been conflated, which is what I was busily writing a note and then I didn't hear your answer. You've got two scenarios possibly being conflated. So the RDA pathway at the moment is being used where you do not have, where for whatever reason the data is inadequate. Whatever that means. You know, there's gaps in the data, whatever, the inadequate data. The other scenario is, and this is the scenario you're proposing, that you can go down the RDA route if the historical data does not include a 1 in 10 year drought, but then you've already told me it doesn't. So therefore, everybody will be going down an RDA route seeking an allocation based on, for example, the Aqualink reasonable use methodology. Correct?
Yes.
Yes. So that's, I think, where you stand. That's so two different. Do you understand there's two different purposes for which you are now, which you've now, you've put two different purposes for the RDA pathway?
I guess some of my thinking behind that, and it's not quite answering the question, I don't think, but my philosophy for, I guess, advocating or proposing the benefit of reasonable use, is that that's where we probably ultimately want to get to in terms of the objective of sustainable water management. So why stop people getting there? But if people have been using it, and I also support the notion within Plan Change 7 that people shouldn't immediately be dropped down from their current use, because they possibly there's a number of people out there that would seriously do damage to.
So if they go to reasonable use on the aqualic methodology?
If
everybody's on a border dike, or everybody's wild flooding is going to be
anyone that's on a border
caught.
Dike is going to struggle to achieve 80% application efficiency.
And so, wild flooding. So there's two. Yeah. So we've got 23% of permit holders are going to be disadvantaged under an aqualic methodology, correct?
Yes. I'm not sure what the percentage is. But
That from somebody's evidence from the primary sector. Who was
Dr.
it?
Crystal.
It was the economist, Mr. Burt, for lamb and beef.
I think Dr. Crystal had the percentages.
Did she?
On her
evidence. Okay. You might be right. Somebody did, and it was like astonishing that we were so high here. But anyway, that's but we are. So why are we recommending this as a method?
Why are we suggesting? Well, it's been suggested as an alternative method. So for those that, for whatever reason, their data doesn't accurately reflect their use or their need, then there is an alternative, and it's a sensible alternative. It's an alternative which is good for a variety of reasons. It gives people what they need if they've got an efficient system. It leads to efficient and effective use of water. But if people are using methodologies which would struggle to achieve 80% application efficiency, for example, then there's an alternative that serves them well too. Provided they've got some data that they can use to demonstrate the historical use.
Might use of, for example, the Aqualink guideline methodology result in water being allocated beyond the limits of historical use? And perhaps if you could hold a scenario in your mind when you think about that, where you have a lower priority water abstractor who simply hasn't had access to reliable supply of water. When you run the Aqualink calculation, it may calculate much higher daily, monthly and annual volumes compared to that which they've historically been able to take.
I guess that's theoretically possible, but I'm not sure that it's a practical problem, because if a person has not used their a reasonable amount of water simply because they haven't had access to it, they will probably continue to not have access to it. Water isn't suddenly going to magic itself into availability simply because someone goes through a restricted discretionary pathway and gets a consent based on reasonable use.
Would your answer be predicated on then the need to ensure that the current manner by which water is taken across a catchment continues? I wonder whether I might give you another scenario to think about where you have...
Sorry, I didn't actually hear your answer to that question.
I didn't answer that question.
Oh, you didn't. Did you want to?
could you repeat it, please,
so
Mr. Moore?
If you have the highest priority holder abstracting water at the bottom of a catchment, and the lowest priority holder was taking water from the top of the catchment, from a physical perspective, the water's flowing past the point of intake, so the exercise of the priorities may be having an impact on how much water is available.
So the person at the end of the line may well, with the lowest priority may not get sufficient, is that?
No, not quite.
Yeah, so as I understand the proposition, the person with the highest priority is at the mouth of the river. And the person with the lowest priority is at the top of the river, or top of the trip, it doesn't really matter. If the person at the top of the trip with the lowest level priority now gets an allocation based on reasonable use, that is potentially going to, based on a 1 in 10 year dry, that is potentially going to increase the amount of water which otherwise they have been taking, because they have been subject to the person at the bottom of the catchment exercising rights of priority and telling them to get off the supply when the flows in the river are trending down. If all that goes, and now at the top of the river, they've got a higher allocation, or even actually existing allocation, but for the purpose of the argument, a higher allocation, does that not? Would that not impact on the potentially impact on the flows available lower down the catchment? I think is where you're going with this, and it probably depends on the irrigation infrastructure and its ability to take more. But what's your response to that?
Does it make any difference?
Because your allocation, if your allocation...
Their paper allocation may be more than they've been taking.
No, I think we've... I don't know whether we're going to... I understand what you're saying, though I suspect it's probably dependent on the irrigation infrastructure at the top of the catchment, whether it could take more if it's allocated more. But it might.
In short, my question is the potential for that situation to exist if Aqualink is the method used to calculate monthly, daily and annual volumes.
Do you understand the priority system, or not really?
Well, I understand that it exists. I don't understand the intimate workings of it.
Oh, neither. We haven't heard much about that ourselves, so we're just using our imagination. Okay, all right.
Does it really matter, though?
Why is he worried about
that? Because we're only allocating people the amount of water they need using the Aqualink methodology.
But the situation might exist that the amount of water that somebody needs exceeds that which historically they've had access to.
Not because of what they consented to take, but because they've been physically constrained by the amount of water that's left, that's available to them.
Yes, which may be a reflection of, for example, the priority system.
Yes.
And insofar then as the Aqualink model is referred to, then significant care would need to be taken if reflecting historical use was the outcome to be achieved. If the Aqualink model was not reflecting something greater than historical use.
I don't think there's an issue if there's enough data to accurately reflect historical use. The sort of situation that we were concerned about is if the data that's available doesn't accurately reflect historical use, in which case you're not going to know whether it's greater or less than the Aqualink methodology would deliver, then in those circumstances where we can't accurately estimate historical use, then the fallback position is Aqualink methodology or something akin to it.
I don't think so, because you're wanting taken volumes based on a 90% reliability as opposed to reflecting historical use. Again, the it's not the same.
Which may be based on less reliability.
Yes. So that's, because I think earlier to another witness I had said, well, if there are problems with the data, could that not be tested under the RDA by employing methods such as Aqualink to verify whether the data was actually accurately reflecting historical use or not at all, and so that the two pieces of information could come together and be taken into account in terms of setting the allocation. But I was told that wouldn't work for border dikes and wild flooding, so that's fine, that's off the table. But also, Aqualink does assume reliability of supply as well, which if you employ that, it may not reflect your historical use. So there could be a shift from your historical use to something else.
Mm-hmm. That's not a problem for the environment, though, is it? Because if people did get an Aqualink model could be applied to a different reliability too, but even if a volume was allocated based on 90% reliability, it's not going to and that number was greater than historical use. Over the years, there's not going to be more water taken because the reliability is the reliability. If they haven't been able to get reliable supply in the past, they're probably not going to be able to get reliability still. So people, water users, will probably end up not taking any more water, I would argue.
I don't know. That depends. Doesn't that depend on, for those people with deemed permits? Deemed permits could be regarded as a type of flow sharing arrangement as between abstractors. You agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah. So reliability being determined by the arrangements within that flow sharing group of people who hold priorities in relation to each other. Correct?
Yeah.
So reliability is not, to that extent, reliability is contingent on things other than the flow in the river. It's based on demand by other users. Is that not so?
Yes, partly, although that in turn is dependent on flow in the river.
I didn't think Aqualink methodology had any environmental benefit. Its benefit is to calculate what is the reasonable use or reasonable demand for a particular farm. Mm. Correct?
No, it's a method that's applied once on top of a limit setting process.
Which we don't have.
Which we don't have.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
But it does guard against people using water inefficiently. There's efficiency built into it.
To that extent, there's an environmental benefit.
The assumption is that the environmental stuff will have already been done, and then an Aqualink or Aqualink-like methodology is used on top of that to ensure that people get the water they need, not more than they need, and that they use it efficiently.
So that not being the case, then what? Anyway, I'll hand it over to you, Mr. Moore. Sorry.
So that not being the case...
That's not the case for either Schedule 10A4 or for the Aqualink methodology. And I would argue that the Aqualink methodology is just as good, if not better, environmental-wise, and that it does ensure that people don't take more than they need if they use the water efficiently. So people get allocated the amount their crop needs, and in order to tap into that amount, they've got to use it efficiently. If they don't use it efficiently, well, they don't get as much as their crop needs in a growing season.
I did have one more question. Whilst we're in the middle of this, under your approach, would land use change, or is land use predicated on a certain year? So, for example, if I'm growing sheep and beef now, under your method, would the reasonable use be based on sheep and beef, or could I say, using the same irrigation system, so there's no additional outlay, I now want to grow dairy beef or beef or something which is different. Yeah. Mm.
Well, all of those options use pasture, and that's the, so I guess that's the crop you're growing. With the water, you might feed it to different animals further down the track. But if you're assuming the same sort of intensity for your
I don't know what
beef,
I'm assuming.
Dairy,
that's the thing.
How would you
apply the methodology?
Oh, well,
would you say there can be absolutely no land use change?
Well, the crop
on a certain year.
The crop you would be talking about would be pasture.
Mm.
But then, you know, there would be changes if you wanted to get into some kind of horticulture or grapes.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody says, well, I'm going to get into grapes or whatever it is, that may mean that you need more water in terms of the change from pasture to... I don't know whether grapes need more water or not, but you'll
probably
know that.
Probably need less.
At least, probably. So it's a bad example, I was thinking there. Well, might need more water than just pasture.
Crops.
Well, we keep getting given cherries, but I was hoping for another example.
Yeah, I don't know anything about cherries.
Fodder for intensive winter grazing. Could that need
something
more
water? Something like that? Would that be in that category?
Yeah, I guess that's maybe a better question for council to answer. I'm not quite sure
what they do
around land use.
Right, well, but perhaps it doesn't matter what it might mean, but assume whatever
but
you want to change to
using an
is going to require more water.
Using a methodology like Aqualink, if the council requires if the council has a land use attached to a water consent.
But it doesn't.
It doesn't,
so
usually.
No. Well, that's my understanding.
Yeah. So I suppose my question is that I've been around quite a long time, and I remember under the old district schemes, you know, people wanted to subdivide their rural land for various reasons, whether it be growing carnations or whatever it was. Really, what they wanted was a lifestyle block, and it didn't really matter what the council tried to do to try and make sure that that transpired. It actually didn't in many cases. And so I'm just wondering how, you know, somebody comes along and they say, I definitely need more water because I'm going to do X. How would you ever make sure that that transpired? I mean, how would you ever tie this reasonable use concept to what's happening on the ground?
Yeah, I guess it's up to council and how it manages its consents, but I would suggest that's really a different topic in a way, and that's got to do with how council manages their consenting processes. In a way, if you've got an amount of water allocated to pasture, sure, other crops will have different requirements at different times, but all plants need to use water, and all plants are exposed to losing water because they need to maintain gas exchange to grow. Some crops will use less water, perhaps because they've got very little leaf area when they're planted, a lot more further on in the season, whereas pasture tends to be more constant in its demand for water, its demand to, yeah, its requirement to take up carbon.
But the Aqualink method does make distinctions by
if the council went down the route of saying we're going to allocate you the right amount of water for a very specific crop, be it cherries or grapes or pasture or whatever else, then that could be done.
So is anyone in your team tested to see what would be the implications of an RDA rule which allows exclusive calculation of the take and volume using Aqualink? So not tied to historical use of water, because I think you've now untied it in your mind.
Mm.
That's correct, isn't it? You've untied it. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Whereas others have tied it.
And
yeah.
In a way that makes sense, because if people who've had a deemed permit or some other permit that expires before 2025, as long as they don't change their land use, then it's rational, I would suggest, to assume that their water need for water is going to continue to be roughly the same.
So then that's an important qualification, provided that the permit holder has not changed their land use.
Mm.
Then it may be calculated in accordance with the Aqualink methodology. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that sounds reasonable to me.
So is that accepting then of one of the other things on the controlled activity, and I think it's also in the restricted discretionary activity, is a requirement that to go down either of those pathways you have to stick within the area of land that you were irrigating, the total area of land you were irrigating between, can't actually remember the years offhand.
September 2017 to June 2020.
I would suggest that for the controlled activity pathway probably doesn't matter, because you're running on historical use, and if they can demonstrate historical use, then if they want to change their land use, they get no more than their historical use. So if they go to something that requires more water, then they're going to be able to irrigate less land area. So probably no harm done. Whereas if they are going to use the Aqualink methodology based on a particular crop, then it is important. They could choose a crop that was... They could theoretically choose a crop that was more water demanding, I guess, and be allocated more water.
Sorry, so you're saying the RDA route, it does matter? You should be limited to the...
Yeah, I think so. To link it back to the Schedule 10A4 methodology, which links allocation to historical use. So if we run the argument that because of record keeping or record availability, representative historical use can't be demonstrated, therefore there's a restricted discretionary pathway enabling some methodology like Aqualink.
I think we're different again.
Well, I'm still misunderstanding what this witness is suggesting for controlled activity. The early notes I took, I didn't understand it then, and I still don't understand it now. So, Mr. Moore, do you want to...
Shall I have a go?
Would you, please?
Mm. I get the question that perhaps we collectively are grappling with is whether you're recommending an unbundling from historic use to with reasonable use for the purposes of the controlled activity, and or something different for the restricted discretionary activity. So I wonder whether we go back to the controlled activity.
Yep.
And I want to understand what your evidence is in relation to the methodology that should be used for the controlled activity.
Well, for the controlled activity, where the joint witness statement got to was that with the amendments that were going to be made to it, presumably, that was fine for, it's historical activity for that consenting pathway.
Historical use?
Yep.
Date range.
Well, over whatever date range the person's got data for. So the proposal was that it wouldn't be constrained to, a 5-year segment, but use whatever reliable data the water user had.
So what years might we be talking about then? What are the possibilities?
Well, that's something I simply don't know. I don't know where people's water records go to. The water meter regulations started to come in 2012, but there's no doubt people that have got records before that were doing water metering for water management reasons. But I don't know. It's really a question.
So even back at 2012, there was a lot more border dyking and wild flooding going on, wasn't there?
Yeah, I presume so. I don't have numbers for that in my head.
So are you accepting then of all the potential implications of going back then, even if, though you don't know what the picture might look like?
Well, if the aim is to reflect historical use, then...
Okay,
that's what it is.
We're probably straying out of his expertise. I think that really is a planning question.
I guess I'm partly trying to understand the basis on which the witnesses in the conferencing process, not necessarily the planning witnesses,
I'm not sure.
have in deciding on the fact that it should be maximum, not sort of the maximum, not well, the averaged maximum over a defined period of time, what they've based all of that on. That's what I'm unclear about in terms of the potential time frames and whether it might mean that you might get a very high figure as opposed to if you're looking in the last 5 years where you might get a lower maximum. That's all.
The rationale on the part of the planners that were part of the primary sector caucus, namely Simon Wilson, his rationale was that council didn't want to disadvantage people who didn't necessarily have the most efficient irrigation system out, people who might be doing border dikes. I don't know if anyone does wild flooding anymore. But, certainly people that had probably outdated methodology, you'd call it respectfully. The notion was that we shouldn't, that council didn't want to disadvantage those people, and that's perfectly reasonable. Therefore, historical use was simply that, historical use, without getting a headache over whether it was historical use that was greater than the reasonable use that you'd get from...
I know where you want to go, and we're going to be releasing in a minute, and it's probably better to manage it.
I think that we will have to leave it that way.
Although I was interested in the RDA question. So controlled historical use, you mean historical land use, correct?
Yep.
And seeking to use whatever data you've got.
Yeah, so historical water use.
RDA. Historical water use.
Yep.
Okay. RDA.
No, and for RDA rather, then reasonable use.
Reasonable use, yeah. I'm not sure that's what that schedule says.
But that
could be the issue that's at large, and whether people are on the same page or not. We don't know what page they're on because they haven't given us much information.
The challenge reading the evidence in chief and then again the summary today, it seems to be that there's perhaps a misunderstanding as to what the RDA pathway is doing in terms of reference to the other methods within the RDA subparagraph A, which is the matter that Mr. De Pelsmaker has highlighted that he's concerned about, and so far as that may result in volumes of water being allocated over and above historic use. And the questioning perhaps has highlighted and identified that there perhaps might be a different understanding. And the witness, correct me if I've misunderstood, but my understanding is that you're saying that the RDA pathway can be used as an alternative platform or pathway based on reasonable and efficient use as opposed to historical use.
And it would be reasonable and efficient use based on the existing land use.
And based on existing area? Based on existing irrigated area.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, why do you think so?
because that reflects historically what the water's been used for.
Okay, now that might make a difference.
The notion is that people should be allocated the right amount of water to grow the crop that they're irrigating. So if they had a...
But the issue still may arise in that that methodology doesn't reflect actual availability of water, and thus may result in a higher volume being allocated compared to historical use.
You mean historic availability?
Yeah. Yeah, that yes. I think we covered this slightly before also. If people were allocated a reasonable annual volume based on existing land use, and it was greater than historical use because of lack of availability historically.
People allocated reasonable and efficient volume based on land use, and?
And if that was greater than historic use because of lack of water availability historically, well, I would suggest that that lack of availability is going to continue on, and while they might be allocated more, they're certainly not going to be using more.
Because you say they wouldn't have access to the more, whatever the more looked like.
Yeah. But if they've got a particular land use, they've obviously been able to carry out that land use. So they must have been getting enough water to do what they've been doing. Otherwise they wouldn't be doing it. So maybe we're chasing our own tails here a bit. I don't know.
Not at all. I should say that for the purpose of your evidence, the two controls based on historic land use, based on existing area, are pretty fundamental. Yep. Not chasing your tail at all. Yeah. Okay.
When you've been thinking about the use of other models, you have referred in both your evidence in chief and your summary, you've referenced Schedule 10 of the Canterbury Land and Water Regional Plan.
Yes.
Now, that methodology has been used in circumstances where the underlying planning framework includes a full flow and allocation regime, so the limit setting process has occurred, and that's quite a different situation to the situation presented in the Otago region presently.
Yes.
And again, simply moving to that type of methodology in the absence of understanding the allocation and flow regime which ought to precede its application results in a situation where the methodology is not responding to environmental issues in relation to resource allocation.
Yes, I guess that's true, but I don't think that helps us when we're considering either Schedule 10A methodology or reasonable use methodology. In fact, I would argue that reasonable use is probably a better option environmentally if there are no limits set, no environmental limits set, simply because you are requiring a greater level of efficiency of water use and therefore probably less water use.
Is that predicated on all users within a catchment then being required to achieve reasonable use?
Sorry, I didn't quite understand the question.
Is that answer predicated on all users within, say, a catchment being required to take only those amounts reflective of reasonable use?
Well, I guess any impact would be greater the more people went down that route.
One of the challenges here is that under the controlled activity pathway, those inefficient users can continue to use inefficiently over the next 6-year period. But the restricted discretionary pathway that you're seeking or suggesting might be opened up, reflective of reasonable use, might then provide a further platform where other users may end up being allocated water at higher volumes than that which reflects their historic use. And so the benefits of shifting to efficient use may not accrue in this situation.
Depends. Yeah, I think we partly had this argument before. If the amount of water allocated was greater than historic use, and historic use was constrained because of lack of availability of water, then the same lack of availability of water, I would suggest, would continue on regardless of which consenting pathway people have been through. The physical constraints are the physical constraints, and no plan provisions are going to change that.
What are physical constraints?
Of the amount of water that's available to take. People can't take what's not there.
Could that constraint be an irrigation infrastructure constraint which can be remedied by change of systems?
Mm.
Yes.
Yeah, people could overcome that. But yeah, unless you change your land use or your irrigated area, then sure, you may take water and use it more efficiently, but well, in fact, if people upgraded an irrigation system without changing their land use or without changing their irrigated area, then there's going to be more water left in the surface water body, I would suggest. And in fact, people often rely on changing land use or expanding irrigated area in order to do an upgrade of an irrigation system. And that's another point that needs to be considered, really, is do we want to stop people from upgrading to a more efficient irrigation system?
So one of those interesting thoughts. So one of the things we could ask experts to do is to actually test the, test this question of, is there a change in volume if you hold the irrigation area and hold the land use?
Mm-hmm.
Is there a change in volume under a reasonable and efficient use pathway? So that's a pathway. It's quite a different pathway for testing historic use under the RDA where there's a data issue. Using the AquaLink methodology is one of, to verify what that volume might be. So that's a different purpose, if you like. So you've got now two purposes.
Mm-hmm.
But we could ask the questions and have the test done, because at the moment we're just flying a little blind as to, is there more water used, not more water used? Yeah.
And that's perhaps one of the challenges. And I don't mean this critically of recommending a change of methodology without necessarily understanding what the implications of that are.
And we've got very little by way of that. But again, that's reflecting the complexity of the subject matter and, time available for everybody to get their heads around it and demonstrate the implementation of the methodology using agreed scenarios, and then of course the question is whether the agreed scenarios are in fact wide enough to have. Yeah.
Mm.
All right.
Right.
I had, I thought, two other questions for you, which Ms. Riley pointed in your direction. So let me just refresh my memory as to what they were. First relates to the date range in terms of what years that should be used, and I want to explore with you the cut-off of 30 June 2020, which remains the position of the Council's planning witness. Now, my reading of the joint witness statement is that you are of the view there should be no restriction in terms of the 30 June 2020 date, and that all future data should be used. Have I understood that correctly?
Yes, that's my recollection.
You accept that with the shift to maxima as opposed to average maxima, that the ability to influence the data set is easier in terms of one-off abstraction events?
Presumably people whose consents, who have deemed permits, for example, which expire this year, are going to have to make a consent application this year, presumably. So there's very limited time to do that anyway, I would have thought.
So what about those applicants or consents that don't expire until 2025? Mm. And it's perhaps that situation where the greatest risk arises. Should you accept that there is a risk?
Yeah, there's a theoretical risk.
And insofar as there is a theoretical risk, who should bear that risk, the environment or the abstractor?
Well, I guess it's the council's task to mitigate that risk, remove that risk, if it perceives there is a risk.
And insofar as the council perceives there to be a risk, if it mitigates that risk or addresses that risk by retaining the date of 30 June 2020, you could understand that being an appropriate response.
I can understand it being a response. I'd need to give a bit more thought about to whether it's an appropriate one or not.
That may be a matter on which some further conferencing may assist in terms of understanding the potential risk profile.
Yes.
And just to round that out, my understanding is there may not have been sufficient time in the conferencing to really explore the consequences of shifting or removing those date restrictions.
Mm. Yeah, I do remember it being discussed, but it wasn't discussed at length.
And I'm sure the earlier date might also be explored when Commissioner Edmonds asks you some questions as well. We have covered the second matter on which I had scribbled your name beside. Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you.
Probably already heard a lot from the court anyway. Any re-examination, or should we just move to the court's questions?
Yes, I'm fine. Court questions.
Okay. Any questions?
Well, I think that I had actually asked them along the way, and
so did I.
We had determined that we might sharpen up our draft minute just to reflect to the wider group considering some of these issues, some of our questions. Mm. So I think I can leave it at that.
Good. I can leave it at that.
Can I ask you a question?
You want me? Oh, okay. talking in the back, is that, you know, in the JWS for planners, planners have linked the RDA rule with the matter of discretion being within the limits of historical use, look at other methods, one of which, I guess, could have been aqualink, but that's, you know, something to come. What you're talking about is not ground truthing historical use through other methods such as aqualink. You're talking about an entirely new RDA route based solely on reasonable and efficient land use, which is tied back to historic land use and historic area under irrigation, so assuming no increase in irrigation area. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's a different route. Route B of the RDA, I think. Yeah. The advantage if you take your route is that users will get 90% reliability of supply, but the other advantage, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that for some irrigators, certainly not all irrigators, but some, that may support an irrigation upgrade.
Yes.
Yes. But not all, or others will require an expansion in the irrigation area and change in land use to generate more income to pay off the debt for the irrigation upgrade. So it's only some people who could take advantage of that.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Right. And then, so under the present wording of the controlled activity pathway, which is based on historical metering, that would not include your alternative, that would stand on its own as one pathway. Is that your understanding?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. We don't have any further questions, no further questions. Anything arising? Well, I should really say, you want a final opportunity. Normally, you'd have a lawyer, you'd say, who might re-examine you just to make sure that you've said everything that you've wanted to say and nothing's been missed out or, you know, run over by questions by cross-examining lawyers. Is there anything else that you want to say?
No, I don't think there is.
Okay. Right. Is there anything arising from the court's questions? No. All right. So, thank you very much for your evidence and... That's us, yep.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okie dokie. So, anybody else you're calling today?
We have Mr. Philip Hunt and Rowena McDermid, both farmer witnesses.
Okay.
And, Your Honour, I have talked with the farmer witnesses as to what matters they may cover that address some of the questions posed mm-hmm. earlier, and they will talk within all matters within their understanding around water sharing agreements, etc., as it relates to them. But we understand the detailed information that will come to the court will be from those specific users in May when the court hears from individual farmer deemed permit holders who are part of water sharing agreements. So they will touch on some matters where it's within their knowledge today, but we understand May will be where the majority of those farmer water users will present before you.
And so your witnesses can talk to their own experience of either deemed permits or water sharing agreements?
If they have any, yes.
If they have any, yes. Yeah. Because if they don't, not to worry, because...
No.
We'll find a farmer. Okay.
You will. I know there will be some coming before you in May, okay. So that answer will be provided to you then.
Okay.
Great. Thank you, Your
Honour. So, you're right. It will take probably the afternoon adjournment and then come back for your last two witnesses.
Okay, thank you.
Please all stand.